This is Charles Amerikanian, and part two of Ode to Gravity. Our program again features composer Brian Eno in conversation on February 2nd, 1980 at the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California. This portion concludes with a look at Eno's collaboration with David Byrne in the production of the 1980 release My Life in the Bush of Ghosts. But it begins with a look at the history of the recording studio as a compositional tool from the unique vantage point of Brian Eno himself. We've heard his work in the recording studio so far in this program. Maybe, Brian, you could talk a bit about your impressions of its history.
Well, it's quite a long story, and so I'll miss out the first stage. The first stage is the transition from cylinders to discs to wire and so on, and in a sense isn't very interesting because it didn't, or for our purposes, it didn't modify what composers were doing a lot. It wasn't until tape came onto the scene that composers started to think of the record or the recording process as a different thing from the compositional process as it had been known before. And tape, the most important thing about tape is that it changed music from being an event in time to being an event in space, at least for the length of time that it was on that tape. As soon as something is recorded, you're dealing with it in the same sense that you're dealing with any plastic material. It becomes malleable, you can edit it, you can reverse it, stretch it, and so on and so on. And of course then when it's played back, it once again becomes an event in time, but during that interim period where it's a spatial event, you can do lots of things with it. Lots of things that you never had available prior to the invention of tape. It took a while before anyone started seeing the possibilities of this, and I guess the first person who really did was Les Paul. He was the first, Les Paul and Mary Ford were the first people who started using multi-tracking, which is to say building up a performance in unreal time, really. Until that time, the concept of recording involved a number of people standing in front of a number of microphones and performing their piece, which then went onto a record. And Les Paul was the first person, at least in a big way, I'm sure there were many experimenters before him, but he was the first person in a big way to experiment with the idea of building up a piece over a period of time by adding, in his case, many, many guitars. And those pieces still sound very, very attractive now, and very modern, actually. After Les Paul, quite soon after, rock music began to be invented. And in rock music, one of the first noticeable things was that the recording started moving away from being in some way figurative. That's to say, prior to the first sort of Elvis records and so on, the function of the producer was to attempt to recreate the image of some recognized environment, like a concert hall or a cave, by the use of echoes and synthetic acoustics of certain kinds. With Elvis, I can remember the most impressive thing about him, for us in England anyway, was this bizarre sound. The tape echo that he had on his voice, which was quite unlike anything that you would ever hear naturally. And in a sense, it was the first commercial, synthetic, really synthetic use of the studio. I think you've got that. Have you, Heartbreak Hotel? Yeah, just play a bit of that. It still sounds pretty strange now.
Oh.
Brian, you mean Elvis didn't really sound like that in person?
No, actually, he didn't. He didn't have quite that repeat on his voice in person.
Hi, I'm Elvis.
A very excellent piece of music, I think. And as I said, it obviously has a quite synthetic sound, which you wouldn't hear in performance. And that was really, in a sense, the beginning of the use of the recording studio in rock music. It began to be divorced from the idea that the record was in some sense a reproduction. But of course, this wasn't by any means explicit until, well, at the late 60s, I'd say. And you still had this tension between engineers feeling on the one hand that their job was to reproduce something with fidelity, and on the other hand, wanting to put on these bizarre echoes. So you had some very interesting and strange results come from that. And the other point, of course, is that rock music has always been teetering on two borderlines. One is the borderline of a very advanced technology, and the other is the borderline of people using it who don't have a clue of what to do with it. And of course, that's what kept the advanced technology interesting. The big problem with computer music for me is that everyone knows how to use it too well, and it just doesn't have that idiosyncratic and human element. I mean, you can't imagine anything in computer music like Heartbreak Hotel, can you? No one would dare do it. But it's this interesting mixture that has always been the case in rock music and in popular ethnic music, of people finding something and being just fascinated by it, like tape echo. Hey, that's great.
And leaving the rough edges on it.
And just leaving it real rough, yeah. And in fact, not having a clear enough idea of what they were doing to clean it up. Actually, that's one of the things. You know, you can't really polish something unless you have an idea of what you're polishing towards. I guess they like the rough edges, like I like the rough edges as well.
I'm sure when we get digital recordings, people are going to synthesize tape hiss to make it sound
like funnily enough, I know somebody who's done that already. Yes, a friend of mine, he received his tape back from California, home of the processed sound, and he said, "It's so uncomfortable, I don't like it. I'm going to put some hiss on it." And he did too. He put some hiss back on.
Well, Brian, you know, will you continue, please, with your perception of the history of the recording studio as a compositional tool?
In the Elvis days, of course, things were still being recorded on very simple tape recorders, like, I guess, one or two track tape recorders. The next revolution, well, there were two happening simultaneously. One was the freeing of instruments from the simple role of being amplified acoustic instruments. And the other was the move towards multi-track recording. Now, those two things happening in consort really produced a different idea of composition. The electric guitar you heard on the Elvis record, of course, is a long way away from an acoustic guitar. It has a very electric sound. And this electronic sound began to be the common sound for a guitar. And gradually it became common for all of the other instruments as well. And the term electric guitar, for instance, ceased to have any specific meaning. It meant one of a very large number of possible sounds. So the composer was now working with a very, very extended palette of sounds compared to, say, the classical composer he'd been working with. If he wrote clarinet in his score, he knew that there were a specific and finite number of sounds that could come out from that instruction, and that the timbral differences from one to the next were at least knowable. You don't have that knowledge with an electric guitar. So you have the extended palette happening via electronics. Also via electronics and tape technology, you have the multi-track recording. Now, multi-tracking effectively means that you're in a position of being able to isolate each instrument on a separate track and to keep it isolated until the final mix. That means any time you can take that instrument off, replace it with another one, add a particular type of sound to that instrument, a unique echo to one sound, raise levels of one note in favor of another, and so on and so on. So this all of course used to be done by the producer rather than the artist, but of course now artists do that themselves. And so the producer became almost a recomposer of the piece for a while, of Spector was, of course, the paradigm of this kind of producer. He was an absolutely brilliant producer who was one of the first people to realise that the studio had absolutely nothing to do, if you wanted to, with realism. If you listen to Spector's drum sound, they're gargantuan, enormous drums, unrelated to any drum sound that you would ever hear acoustically. And so the producer at that stage, Shadow Morton, who did the Shangri-Las, was another instance. He became almost the composer of the piece, in the same way as the producer is the composer of the piece in reggae now. With the development of 24-track technology, unfortunately, one of the byproducts of that was that people felt that, well, we've got more tracks, therefore we can put more instruments on. And the tendency became that one filled all of one's 24 tracks, and that if you had a couple of tracks free, you were in some way wasting your money. And consequently, music tended to get very clogged and became fuller and fuller. Until, two things entered into this equation to change that. One was reggae, and particularly dub, and the other was New Wave, which made a very deliberate return to a much simpler and sharper statement, an undecorated statement. Perhaps I could play this Lee Perry piece. Sure. This is by the reggae producer Lee Perry, and it's a very different approach to recording. The style I've been talking about, the additive style, you could say is painterly. It's just adding colour all the time, building up a picture. This is different. It works rather in reverse. You start with the full picture, and then you subtract instruments. So it's like a sculpted version of a song. You'll hear instruments disappearing and suddenly being radically altered in terms of their sound.
Set up your set, Bali, and don't be like Bonnie and Clyde. If you wanna stay alive, chill ya. You dread in a jam down, ya. You dread in America. You dread in a London. You dread in a Babylon. Home of the fittest of the fittest shall stand. Set up your set, chill ya.
Okay, that was Lee Perry. It's quite a long song. It goes on for another quite a few minutes after that, I think. One of the other great innovators, and probably still the greatest electric guitar player of all time, I suppose, is Jimi Hendrix. He was the first guitar player to realize that the guitar was more than a piece of wood that hung around his neck, and he really understood that there was a relationship between the room acoustics and the amplifier he was using and the whole situation. People who've known him, Fripp was one of them, and Robert Wyatt knew him, I never knew him, say that he wasn't technically a great guitar player, but that they both admire him as the greatest guitar player they ever saw. He was just someone whose whole approach to the instrument was so revolutionary that the technical shortcomings or skills he had were quite immaterial to it. It's interesting that actually a number of the great guitar players have started off with some serious problem. Les Paul had a car accident and his right arm, his playing arm, was permanently damaged, I believe, and he woke up during the operation and said, set it in a guitar playing position, and he had his arm, I understand, he had his arm set so that it could play the guitar, you know. Django Reinhardt, who was a great guitar player, had only two fingers on his left hand, I think, so his fretting hand, there were only two fingers on it. And Hendrix didn't have any of these physical problems, but he was left-handed, and he grew up playing a right-handed guitar, so all of his controls were actually in the wrong place. He never switched over, he always stayed on a right-handed guitar. And I think it's curious that all those three people who were all innovators on the guitar should have... I sometimes conjecture that one of the reasons they innovated was simply because they had to, you know, they couldn't repeat standard formats when they were working at some kind of disadvantage. This recording, it has nothing to do with the recording studio in a sense, since it's a live recording, but it's possibly my favorite Hendrix thing, Star Spangled Banner from Woodstock.
Thank you.
I was just thinking, when they sent that Apollo off with the capsule of things that were supposed to tell you what life was like in contemporary America, that's what they should have put in. I think that just is one of the most extraordinary historical documents, that piece. The first time I heard it, it just made me cry. I thought it was so overpowering. The other record they should have sent is that Randy Newman one, Good Old Boys. I thought that had a lot to tell. Yeah, he extended the electric guitar in a lot of ways. For instance, when he worked in the studio, he would customarily record 26 or 28 tracks of lead guitar, and he would then carefully prune, taking 20 seconds of one, 10 seconds of another, a minute of another one, building up an ultimate guitar solo, the essence of a great guitar solo. And he was absolutely unrestrained in his use of electronics, as is quite clear, and extremely interesting in it. He didn't only use the kind of clean, slick sounds, he used the real dirty sounds too. He was just the greatest guitar player for me. One of the other things that started happening in the late 60s, well, even in the mid-60s, was that the rhythm instruments started becoming very important. Instead of being simply rhythm instruments, that's to say simply things that gave you a kind of comforting thud in the lower part of the sound spectrum, they started actually having real vocal lines and singing parts, and a kind of compression started taking place where the voice wasn't the dominant melodic instrument necessarily, or shared the melodic information with other instruments. Here's a Diana Ross song where you hear a number of, well, a Supreme song actually, where you hear a number of interesting things going on. First of all, electronics are being used in an interesting way. Secondly, the acoustic space is quite fictional. And thirdly, the bass guitar has quite as much to say as Diana Ross's voice, I think.
Through the mirror of my mind, time after time, I see reflections of you and me, reflections of the way life used to be. These tears that I'm crying reflects the hurt I can't control. Cause although you're gone, I keep holding on to the happy time when you were mine. As I peer through the window of lost time, looking over my yesterday, lost from the hurt that you have caused. Everywhere I turn, seems like everything I see reflects the love that used to be.
That was Diana Ross and the Supremes. Like many of the Tamla groups, they were very important, only at the time, in England anyway, they were sort of overlooked as being well, that was the commercial end of what was going on, and they weren't really taken as awfully serious compared to things like the Beatles or the Stones, you know. In fact, in retrospect, what they were doing is quite as far out. Towards the end of the 70s, well, actually earlier than that, in 68, I guess, a man appeared called Sly Stone, who used to be a DJ in San Francisco, I think, originally. And he really started to synthesize a lot of interesting things together. He took elements of James Brown, elements of gospel music, and elements of white rock music, and put them together in a most interesting way. And also, he really started using the rhythm instruments in a vocal fashion, and conversely, often using the voices in a rhythmic fashion. This first Sly song is just about my favorite by him. It's called Everyday People. It's an absolutely beautiful song with the sexiest girls I've ever heard on record. Last night I was saying in the lecture how Sly Stone was one of the really formative influences of the 70s, in that he reshuffled all the instrument roles, and I was talking about how he used bass guitar, and how Graham Central Station were the big Sly follow-up. And of course, looking at this record cover now, it seems that Larry Graham was actually the bass player in Sly Stone, and became Graham Central Station. What's this one? Yeah, let's have a bit of that. That sounds good.
Everything's very forward in these recordings, aren't
they? Yeah, really. Yeah. They're really beautiful. Interesting recordings.
It makes
yeah.
the sound into an object that's kind of hard and very brittle.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. And this is a voice, this lead instrument here, of course. It's a treated voice. It's wah-wah-wah-wah-wah thing. I'm sure it is, yeah. It's like a treated voice or one of those magic bag things. Yeah, right.
Rummaging rummaging through the cassette collection of Brian Eno now.
What a strange collection it is, too. I just noticed when we played, the reason we did that strange changeover in the middle of Everyday People is because the cassette sounded very dull indeed. I wondered whether these cassette heads are dirty here. If they are, they'll be even dirtier now because I'm rubbing my finger over them. This is 8 Miles High by The Byrds, which was one of the first of the psychedelic records. Psychedelia was the, I guess, the white equivalent of what was happening in black music at the time, a kind of redefinition of what popular music could be about. The Byrds, particularly on the album Notorious Byrd Brothers, really were exploring peculiar acoustic spaces and quite new guitar sounds, much to do with McGinn's 12-string guitar, a sound that galvanized many a young person like myself. Yeah, we could listen to a bit of it, I think. Strange listening to that, how much it sounds like The Who, actually. I never realised that before, but that drumming is just like Keith Moon, and the guitar playing is like Pete Townshend in the I Can See for Miles type period. It's peculiar. Those things seem quite far apart at the time.
What were you doing at the time this music was coming out?
I was at
finishing
art school.
Up art school, huh?
Yeah, and I had already started working in experimental music, you might say, but I had never recorded anything or anything like that. I was painting, actually, most of the time. Do you want to hear a bit of Arabic music?
Yeah.
Okay.
We're going to change cassette machines. This one doesn't sound like it's working all that well.
No, it doesn't.
Yeah, go ahead. Arabic music has been a big influence in your life lately?
Yeah, for the last couple of years it has. When I was in Ibiza, I lived in Ibiza for a little while, and... Oh yes, yes, I started tuning into the North African radio stations. What I heard on those I found absolutely extraordinarily interesting, particularly since at the time I was going through a kind of dilemma, listening to a lot of disco records and thinking, well, the rhythm tracks are great, but the singing is just crap, you know, you could forget it all. And it seemed to me that the problem of singing was one of the most interesting ones in music at the time. In fact, having heard quite a few of these Arabic songs, I was prepared to give up completely because I think they really have the edge on us in singing. Not only the Arabs, but also the Thai and the Japanese and the Africans and so on. There are so many cultures that have developed singing so much further than we even dreamed of it. So I'll play you a little piece of an Arabic singer called Farid El Atrash. He's a very popular singer, but he's by no means art or anything like that. He's just a popular radio singer in most of the Arabic countries. There's a good rhythm track on this one, though. And I don't know what he's singing about. There he is. What's really interesting about these pieces is the way they quite effortlessly accommodate electric organs and instruments that we tend to associate with rock music, and just build them in with no problem whatsoever.
I was in Amsterdam a couple of weeks ago. A friend gave me this recording of music from Georgia in the Soviet Union. Try that,
yeah,
for
that
vocal music. This is a record which is out of print in Russia, and a Polish woman gave it to him in Warsaw. It blew my mind completely. And go ahead, play it. I began to think maybe Stravinsky might have heard this at some point. No.
Oh, yes, no, that's right.
This is what they have on the radio all the time, apparently.
Oh,
It's nice we can find all these musical sources to work with these days, isn't
that's
it?
That's really pretty, that piece. Yeah, I mean, that's one of the great freedoms that the contemporary composer has and rarely uses, that he's presented with the culture of the whole world if he chooses to look for it. It's not even very hard to find. You just walk into Tower Records or Rather Ripped or something like that, and there it is, all in front of you, for a few dollars.
I noticed that you didn't, for instance, on the Talking Heads album, mention Hugo Ball's name. Do you tend to be...
mentioned in the if you read the credits
on the disc, it says
composed by Burn Ball Eno or something like that. Eno Ball Burn. Eno Ball Burner. He's mentioned there.
Do you fear any suit at some point from people who might... Yeah.
Well, this is a difficult area. I mean, a long time ago I had an idea that I wanted to make a piece from a little phrase that Jimi Hendrix played on one of his songs called War Heroes, I think the song was, or the album was, anyway. Midnight was the name of the song. There was one little section which had this exquisite guitar sound that lasted, oh, maybe 5 seconds, and I thought I could make a whole piece of that. But I never dared do it because I was sure that I would get sued and, you know, the thing would never be released and so on.
On the other hand, Hugo Ball.
Hugo Ball, I mean, he died in 1922 or something. So what chance has he got? He must be public domain by now, I guess. But with the Arabic people and the Ethiopian man we used in one of the songs, for instance, this is a real kind of moral dilemma. I want to use this material, but of course I'm not going to claim it's mine. Obviously these people are going to be credited duly. But how do you get any other remuneration to an unidentified Ethiopian man recorded 15 years ago? I mean, the only good thing you can hope that comes out of it is that people say, hey, these Ethiopians are interesting, and that in some way you modify their view of Ethiopians and of that kind of music to some extent. But a lot of people object to use of material in that way because they say, well, it's just some kind of cultural chauvinism of you just steal other people's good ideas and fit them into your own. Well, of course that's true as well.
On the other hand, you might be expanding the perception of the individual music's ideals.
Yes, one hopes so. I mean, I just have to use that material. There's no other way about it. I can't see anything better to do at the moment than that. I could play one of those pieces, perhaps.
Yeah, let's see.
Well, in fact, I have to play two. I have to first of all play one that doesn't have these vocalists on, which is a kind of bizarre disco song I'll play some of. And then after that, there's a piece with an Ethiopian man. This is called Garbage Disco. Thank you.
That's a new piece of music by Brian Eno. Brian, when's that coming out?
I think it should be in about a couple of months. It's something that David Byrne and I are working on together. Well, this is something I had done last year with a group of musicians in New York, one of whom was David, and now it's been co-opted into this new project. David and I have been working alone for a couple of weeks, and we had Prairie Prince come in one day. Prairie Prince, the drummer from the Tubes. In fact, he came in a couple of days. Great drummer. And he did some interesting work with us, which I'm just trying to find right now. It's difficult queuing up cassettes in...
There it is.
That's it, yeah. Okay, this features Prairie and David and myself and an unidentified Ethiopian man. So that was the Ethiopian man on an unfinished piece, which has no title as yet, David Byrne, myself and Prairie Prince, and that should be on an album that's coming out in 2 months or something, I guess, whenever we finish it. This next piece, which I'm again trying to find on the cassette, is a very early piece. I mean, it's very early in the sense that hardly anything has happened to it yet. And it features an anguished Brooklyn man calling a talk station and an oily politician replying to him. This song is called Mea Culpa. Yeah, I like that.
I like that very much. Is that finished now?
No.
That's the beginning of something.
That was the first two things that went on, the voices and the synthesizer. Since then, I put on a cardboard box, two ashtrays, and a piece of marimba, which things now form the rhythm section of this song. David and I have been working in peculiar conditions in that we only have a couple of instruments. A guitar and a bass guitar, and we have a synthesizer.
What kind is that?
Prophet.
A Prophet
synthesizer. And so all the percussion we wanted, we've derived from other sources like prepared piano and boxes and tins and so on and so on. And got some very nice sounds, actually, from those strange beginnings.
I take it if somebody gave you an enormous synthesizer to play with, it, you would probably prefer to use your own equipment that you've had for years and you're familiar with. Is that accurate?
I tend to like little synthesizers. As I said last night, I trust anything I can carry, really. And those big synthesizers, I don't know if you really need all those options, you know. And anyway, when you're working in the recording studio, nearly all the extra power that a big synthesizer gives you is already built into the studio. You know, if you want the thing to be polyphonic, well, just track it a few times, you know. You don't have to have chordal synthesizers, for instance. I'm happy with the cheaper things and the simpler things, really.
thanks for coming to KPFA. It's been a pleasure talking with you, and I hope to see you again.
Okay, thank you, listeners, and thank you, Charles.
You've been listening to Ode to Gravity. This program, featuring the work of Brian Eno, originally was broadcast over KPFA in Berkeley on February 2nd, 1980. Thanks to Pacifica Radio, and special thanks to Brian Eno, EG Records, and Opal Limited of London. For continuing periodical information on the work of Brian Eno, you may subscribe to Opal Information, a quarterly newsletter available from the following address. Opal Information, Box 141, Leon C, Essex, England. That's Lee, L-E-I-G-H. So once again, Opal Information, Box 141, Leon C, Essex, England. A comprehensive dissertation on Eno was completed by Eric Tam for the Doctorate in Music at the University of California, Berkeley in spring of 1987. The 400-page work is called Brian Eno, Electronic Musician, Progressive Rock and the Ambient Sound, 1973 to 1986, and it is available from University Microfilms International, 300 North Zeeb Road, Ann Arbor, Michigan, 48106. This program in the Ode to Gravity series was produced with funds provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting through National Public Radio's Satellite Program Development Fund. The program was produced by Arts Plural, which is solely responsible for its content. Engineer for this program was Michael Yoshida of KPFA. Theme music for Ode to Gravity by Henry Kaiser. This is your host and producer, Charles Amerkanyan.